interesting how it works. Here is a Roman galley, at least that's what she thought it was, in the form of a bird, which ought to be swimming on the water. Oars are broken. It's way up in the mountains, beached. There is water falling, all right, but the boat's protected from it. And here she is with her four, just in the way of tourists. You get it. Having refused the entrance into the cave, she has refused participation in her problem. And she's simply viewing it now, as we are, as tourists, not undergoing the experience that would be necessary. Now, she was a well-educated person, and the English style had been educated in Latin and Greek and so forth. And for her, as she interpreted this dream and picture, what this represented was her classical heritage. You remember I spoke last night about two inheritances, the classical and the Near Eastern in the Greco-Roman and biblical traditions. All of her education in the classics is doing her no good. It's beached. It's not carrying her forward. Likewise, her Hebrew, her biblical tradition, wasn't helping her. But this is a major problem today with I would say, almost all of us who remain attached to these two traditions without integrating them in our actual living. We are, as it were, tourists in life with all these formulae along with us, and we're looking at the things but experiencing nothing. It's like going to Nigeria and living in the Hilton Hotel. You're just not in play in the experience. Her analysts would assume, Dr. Adler, here are the menorah representing that tradition. Here she is with her mother. And this isn't doing her any good. And there's her animus riding out the door. It'll be a long time before we see him come back. She has to undergo a great deal. Now is the beginning. She takes the plunge. Now, isn't that a beauty? You notice, now that it's a picture that actually represents some kind of depth experience, her whole style is improved. This is a graceful, wonderful thing for a woman who did the comfortable and uncomfortable trees a few days back. Something has come through here. And you'll notice the birds are swimming as though they were fish. This is a union of a pair of opposites. In Hawaii, there is a sea place, you know, where the dolphins dive and are beautiful. And there's a kind of comic act between all these wonderful things the dolphins do. They let down a group of penguins into the water, and one can see the penguins flying through water. It's a really charming experience. But what it represents, of course, is the union of a pair of opposites. I was asked by somebody today, who in one of the groups apparently, somebody had a dream of a fish with feathers. And this is the same thing. The combination of the two that we think of as separate from each other. A dragon, which has wings, combines qualities of the serpent and the bird. As I said last night, the serpent is something that crawls on the earth and represents the bondage of the spirits to the earthly realm. And the bird is free-flying. Angels are represented as birds with feathers flying, and they are dissociated from the bondage of earth. The Satan and the devils are scaly creatures in the way of serpents. And the dragon is a winged serpent. It's a synthesis of the two, and so represents the transcendence of the opposite. Similarly here. Now, another interesting thing about this, she comes down in seven dives. One, two, three, four, five, six, and then seven at the bottom. In the Indian Kundalini system, or the imagery of the seven stages of the spiritual exaltation of the yogi, we have seven stages. I'll show you this in just a minute. So she's taking the plunge. And now we can expect some interesting things. No longer just somebody standing looking at a cave, just standing looking at a beached craft, riding away from the biblical house. She has plunged into her own unconscious, which is the source of all the imagery of the religions that I've been talking about. And what the different religions of the world do is take those images, inflect them to the local, current, moral, ethical sense. And through the activities necessary to the local life, invoke the development of the spirit. Here's the next one. The lightning flash. This is a primary image for the shattering of the ego position. I don't know how many of you know the tarot cards, but there's a card of the tower being smashed by lightning. That's the tower of the ego. It symbolizes purgatory, where the ego factors are being eradicated. James Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, the whole of Finnegan's Wake is the purgatorial dissolution of the ego, uses the thunderclap as the main motif. But this is a very interesting thunderclap because it's not only the lightning bolt, but also the serpent. And then there comes the rain without any protection anymore. It is pouring down and forming a river down here. These two, the lightning of light, the flash of spiritual energy, and the serpent. I immediately think of this yoga formula. This is the Kundalini. The central column is identified with the interior of the spine. Our spiritual energy is thought of as coiled up at the base, which is called Muladhara, the root support, the root base. The yogi tries to activate that energy and bring it up to these seven centers. And at each center, the whole psychology is transformed. I won't go through the series, but at the level of the heart, so that's chakra number four, is the awakening of the spiritual life. And then the rise to the top is the growth and fulfillment of the spiritual man. But the two side nerves are very important here. The one starting at the left, the gray line, is called Ida and represents lunar consciousness. Consciousness, as symbolized in the moon, bound to the field of time and space, which puts on bodies and puts them off, as I've said. The consciousness of our incarnate spirit. The other represents solar consciousness, that is called the Pingala, consciousness disengaged from the field of birth and death. And as I said last night, the big spiritual moment comes when you identify your consciousness with solar consciousness. And then you can say with Paul, O death, where is thy sting? I am consciousness, but I'm grateful to the body as my vehicle for consciousness. It has brought me to this point, and I now know that my experience is bound by the body, but it's an experience of that solar consciousness. The light of the moon and the light of the sun are the same light. The moon reflected in a body, and the sun primarily radiant. Before you can start the exaltation of the spiritual life from the base to the top, you must bring those two knowledges together. The knowledge of moon, the knowledge of sun, they must unite. Then they can come up. If you don't unite those first and start bringing the energy up, you're going to have an imbalance and you may go crazy. There are plenty of examples of people who've gone crazy through this. Why? If you get it associated only with the solar light, you will think you're so darned exalted that you will blow. And if you think that it is tied up to your physical body only, you will, again, be off balance and think you're it. You are God. The balance must be achieved, and then this can happen. That's what struck her. The two came down in the serpent and the lightning. And the rain stopped. Now is going to begin the rise. And look at her next picture. The serpent is holding her down, and yet it's presenting the golden germ. The very imagery that we were looking at last night. These come to her in visions, in dreams. And every one of these pictures that I'm showing from now on is her attempt to render her dream. The value in doing that is that she's meditating on it. She's incubating it. She's drawing into her consciousness in a secret, almost ineffable way, a way too deep and mysterious for words, the sense of what her dream rendered to her. But she's being held down. So she realizes something has to be sacrificed. There's something still holding her down. Please notice the tree. Here then comes the funeral of that which is holding her down, or she thinks it's its funeral. It's the funeral of her ego commitment. There's the tree, there's a kind of coffin there, and there is a sowing of seed and a nourishing of the seed. There are two women and two men. Two men are holding lights as though it were a kind of religious ceremony. This is a bit too conscious, this picture. It doesn't have the zip of the others. It's a kind of programmed killing of the personality, and she knows that it's got to be done, but she hasn't really done it yet. I give this alchemical picture to indicate the character of the problem. There must be completely killed both the serpent and the consciousness. Both have to be killed. These are the two sides to come down, the two nerves, and they must unite for something that's going to carry us up the center with the phoenix spirit up there. This is sulfur and that's mercury, the two signs of the zodiac. You remember last night I showed this gold coin from the 16th century of the serpent and then the Christ. There's a marvelous text in St. Paul's Epistles to the Philippians where he says, for Christ did not think Godhood something to be clung to, but let go and came down to be born and to die as man. So he gives up Godhood and he gives up manhood, the pair of opposites, you might say, and the dynamism that is manifest in the two is the dynamism of his miracle. With that, she comes to this. This was such a exciting dream that she couldn't draw it all. I mean, it just excited her too much. And even putting the eyes in activated the whole thing again. The dream was of a kind of heavenly demon that came down with a thunderbolt, you see it there, and ravished her, driving it into her breast. That's the body receiving the spirit in a thunderous way, almost too much to experience. Reminds me of this figure of Blake, of the great red dragon and the woman clothed in light of the apocalypse. But you remember in the apocalypse, she was saved from the dragon. That shouldn't happen. When the dragon comes, yield. As in this Tibetan tantric situation. This is a beautiful Tibetan tantra from about the 17th century. It shows that the dark lord, who's known as Raja Chakrasambara Raja, the lord or king of the all-embracing sphere. And he is embracing this red thunderbolt yogini. She's holding the thunderbolt in her hand. represents the dynamic of Earth, the dynamic of life in time. He represents the impact of the transcendent, and they unite here as one. So this is the vivid, radiant aspect of this union. The figure that they are trampling down here are the dark one, fear of death, and the light one, desire for continued life, the ego. And down here, this bull-like monster represents the terror of judgment, judging your ego. The radiant figure at the top represents the peace that is inherent in this moment. And then the figures round about, that one up in the upper left is called Hevajra, the excitement and delight of the thunderbolt. This is called Chakra Raja, the holder of the Wheel of Time. This one down here is the thunderbolt holder, and this wonderful figure is called Purbu, a spirit nail. It symbolizes the power to pin down disturbing thoughts when you're meditating. Now, I might say that this my experience this morning of the silent hour was to me a very moving and important experience. I've never been to a Quaker meeting before, and I had a good many thoughts that should have been pinned down by this fellow that had to do with simply earthly matters right there in the room, enjoying people coming in and seeing how they were and all that. But I did have a couple of moments of getting into myself. And I might say that the thought that occurred to me was this. If you're going to have a ritual, have a ritual, a good, real bang-up ritual like that of Easter Sunday, Solemn High Mass in Chartres Cathedral, which actually was the last Mass I attended 50 years ago. And if you're not going to have a ritual, have this. Just the silence of individual meditation, and not some sermon that some clergyman made up the night before, and used handbooks that have given texts, and singing hymns that are 2,000 years out of date, and all that sort of thing. This seems to be a beautiful moment, and this just now inspires this thought. Perhaps some of you people would like to know more about the Purbu and how it's been nailed down, obstructing thoughts. Okay, she has yielded. The red and white with the dot in the center represent the eye of that demon that ravished her. And as she was painting it, she realized it was her eye, too. You have a symbol here uniting a pair of opposites, uniting him and her. And out of that comes the larger thing of the whole cosmic sky. This is the beginning now of a very interesting process in her therapeutic series. I'm giving another alchemical picture here to illustrate the theme of the circulation of the light, a wheel that turns and turns, bringing up to below and below to above, round and round. And her next picture was of this. This wheel circulating and pulling in boats which were full of fish. The fish represents, as we've said, the energy in the depth of the unconscious. And we've seen that reflected tree with ourselves, as it were, in the water. In early Christianity, the legend of Noah was, Jonah, is interpreted as the self, or the Christian self, saved from the fish of just life in the dream waters. And then, of course, we have this beautiful thing of Duccio, of Christ calling the fishermen, telling Peter, "I will make you fishers of men," drawing the lost men who are simply in the water of the dream of their lives out and unshelling them from the fish. So that was her image. And then came this extraordinary piece, she has a dream of a plunging eagle up here, which in the course of its plunge broke into five and became five doves, and then broke into a swarm of starlings, which in their form resembled a serpent. There's a kind of union. The eagle representing the predatory animal, the dove representing love, peace, and the starlings here in the serpent representing the mob, you might say, the unilluminated world. She sees it all as one above the skyline of the city. This made me think of this from that very good chalice of the Duke of Berry, of the fall of the rebel angels, how the angelic power, feathered angels like great birds and eagles, plunges down to become the serpent of Satan in the garden. So it's all one world. And Dante, you will remember, at the very last of his Heaven book, the Paradiso, the last canto, tells how when he beheld the beatific vision and saw how the radiant wheels of light were one with the three persons of the Blessed Trinity, he was suddenly, with a great insight, filled with the realization of the whole of the universe is God's love, even the abyss of hell. With that, she had the dream entering a cave. The bird, the eagle of the sun, had become the doves of the moon and the love, and the dragon of the abyss. And in the abyss, she finds the water course. Now, she didn't dream of herself going into the cave. She dreamt of a little man whose name was Mr. Prentice Jones, with a portfolio under his arm, going into the cave. That's her animus. And that is she, as the lady secretary in Geneva. Well, so Dr. Adler said, well, okay, why not now keep Mr. Jones's diary? Why not just to tell us, day by day, what he experienced as he went into the cave? This is a very interesting device, by the way. If you have a dream like this, of your animus or anima on an exploration, to his diary. And as she was doing the diary, this came about. He discovered a great water course down there. You must remember that Satan is Lucifer, the Lord of Light, enclosed in serpent form. So we're releasing Lucifer from the serpent body, and we're discovering the water in the abyss of the earth, the inexhaustible fountain. The fountain that I showed you yesterday, which is the source of all life and source of all good as well as evil. This is another Blake picture. I found when I want a more or less modern artist who really knows what symbols are about and has had all of these experiences, Blake is the man to look for. Here is the soul exploring the grave. Now we're going down into the grave, and what you see here is a body in flames. What she found in the abyss of the cave was a great pond, fed by streams from the eight directions, the four points of the compass and the points between. That's a major mythological motif. The four people there with mountain climbing and cave exploring equipment. And the North Star in the middle of the pond. There's an important saying in alchemical texts and in the Hermetic texts of late Alexandrian times, what is above is below. What is not here is nowhere. And here in the abyss, is the heavens. And so her next picture is of this heavenly circle. There's the same star in the center with all the celestial constellations, including the Southern Cross and the Pole Star. Then, and the separation of the elements, and minors, like Walt Disney's dwarfs. A terrific flame. I remind you of the salamander motif and the flames in the pictures of last night. Then herself in flames. Now, at last, we have the sacrifice. That which was intellectually conceived of in that burial scene is here a reality. Something has happened to her. She is in flames. And from her right hand come the seeds of the grape, which becomes then the wine of the sacrament of the altar. And from the left hand come the seeds of grain, which becomes the host or bread of the sacrament of the altar. She is that Jesus who is crucified, and whose flesh is flesh indeed, meat indeed, and whose blood is drink indeed. And above her, we have the New Jerusalem, which is very much like the purgatorial mountain, up which the soul ascends to the heights, the earthly paradise, and from there, meeting Beatrice in Dante's image, ascends to the higher spheres. Now keep that in mind, this picture, and here is the Dantean. Down here, the descent into hell. Here, the purgatorial mountain. At the in the earthly paradise, the meeting with the friend, Dante and Beatrice, and then the guidance to the height of the planets and spheres in the order of Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And here is the church, which is supposed to help us to avoid the pains of hell and to pass through the pains of purgatory to heaven. And here is Dante with his book saying, perhaps you had better do better reading this. The next picture is of herself now as a heap of ashes with a question mark. This you might call the dark night of the soul. But she has hope, and the hope is represented in the rather lugubrious rainbow that she has given us here. Now she's still down in the cave, still keeping that diary, and she has a dream of a great mosaic mandala. Here's the first of three really fascinating mandalas. This is a mosaic mandala. That's to say, a mandala put together intentionally of pieces. She has thought about this, she's thought about that, she's put it all together. And in the dream, this has yielded a mandala. In the dream, the center was missing. And something like two or three dreams later, she met someone in the dream that handed her that tablet, which is now the center of her dream mandala. You can see she has spent a long time working on this. And in the long act of reproducing as well as she could the mandala of her experience, she was integrating its sense. Then she had a terrifying dream. And this now is the click, the final moment. It's the dream of a great London railroad station. I don't know how many of you remember those old stations. I don't know how they are now in London, because we always go in by air and all that sort of thing. But they were great big sort of glass domes, and the train was down here puffing its smoke. She dreamed that a Nazi bomber was flying around inside the station, and that this Nazi bomber finally dropped its bomb